Turning now to, we stay actually in the same region. Veronika Wendland is also part of of several councils, Petersburger Dialog.
I will bring the up at the Petersburger Dialog in November, where we have our annual convention.
Yeah.
I will look for Sajusiki in this case.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. So I will speak from here, because otherwise I will not see the left wing of our audience. So Peter, you began with several questions. And I picked two of them. The question, which models we can develop for tackling current minority issues, and the other question, which of course concerns all of us, which is the role of experts in this culture. So let me begin with some rather self-reflexive remarks about expertise. So I have asked the question, what is basically my expertise in this, since I, as Olga, I'm no minority researcher in this sense. I have been working as a researcher in several fields, in the field of nationalism studies, and then in the field of urban history, and actually I'm doing science and technology studies and environmental history. I'm just completing a book on the history of nuclear technology and nuclear technology in Eastern Europe, and for this book I did field work in a Ukrainian nuclear power plant community. So I did something like a sociologist or an anthropologist. And when colleagues, historians, ask me, why did you drop Galicia, Renaissance, Lemberg, Liu, and the Habsburg monarchy in favor of socialists from the scratch multi-story concrete boxes, I overtly admit that this was partly due to a process of, say it, alienation, you know. Because my previous sources from Galicia and from Russia and from Poland, interwar Poland, were very, very often about ethnocentric projects, about obscurantist anti-Semitism, on strategies of nationalist inclusion or exclusion, and of course, eventually on the social segregation of urban communities in the wake of the nationalizing process which is going on in these communities. So ironically speaking, I was overfed with this, and I turned to the transnational and, as we Germans call, Vaterlandsloses, the non-patriotic or unpatriotic uranium atom, which was once the darling of leftist physicists and engineers. Once nuclear energy was a leftist project, a progressivist project. So this is, of course, an idealist illusion, since studying nuclear technology means, first of all, studying the pivotal technology of national grandeur in the 20th century, and which is, in the same time, a powerful integrating agency which makes and shapes social identities. So when I studied the multi-ethnic post-Soviet nuclear community of Kuznetsovsk in northwestern Ukraine, I quickly learned that a transnational reactor concept, of course, does not prevent its operators from becoming objects of imperial or national integration, language policies, and so on. However, when doing fieldwork at the Rivne nuclear power plant, in the crucial Ukrainian-Russian conflict years between 2013 and 2015, I learned another thing as well. I learned that this is not the one and only process which is worth to discover, this national integration process or imperial integration process. I learned that under the everyday conditions of nuclear work, and moreover under external pressure, multilingualism and multiple identities do not provide ground for conflict, given the fact that people share one very powerful and integrative social identity, which is strongly related to their work. In a way, as the Russians put it, reaktor должен работать, or in Ukrainian, reaktor має працювати, so the reactor has to work. This is, in fact, the cultural program of the Atomshiki, of those nuclear people. It is all a program about that, and it produces a feeling of social cohesion and social security, because this work in the industry gives social security as well. Ironically, there was much of safety and security concerns related to this situation. So, for example, national security, as energy infrastructure security, nuclear safety in times of war. Of course, the question was arising, what will we do at our nuclear plant if the war is coming to us? And also a discourse implied from the outside, namely whether Russian-born, Siberian-born nuclear workers may constitute a security risk for a Ukrainian nuclear power plant during war with Russia. So, however, as we can observe from or in the former industrial areas of Eastern Germany, such industrial identities are really fragile. Under external pressure, they can decay very quickly because they are connected to the functioning of a socio-technological system. If it doesn't function, their identity will wane, fade. So if this mode of identity building is no more available since the industry has gone to crap together with the biographies of people, other group identities quickly replace the previous one. People build then new identities on a new situation definition, as we say in our Sonderforschungsbereich, a situation definition which is, for example, we belong to a disenfranchised collective. And in the next step, we belong to a disenfranchised and forgotten minority, as it's now the case in Saxony, for example, where 30% of people are voting for the AfD. Whereas other minorities, allegedly, such as refugees, are supposed to be privileged minorities with access to resources that are denied to the own minorities, the native group. So, coming back to our question, what could serve as a future model for managing such minority issues? So, it's not only the ethno-national, but it's simply the self-concept of groups. Before suggesting a model, I would propose another time a self-reflexive and self-critical and tentative position on minority issues. Since tackling the problems of our present society under the frame of minority issues, this does, in my opinion, imply several risks. First of all, a reductionist view. So problems with mobility, labor, participation, industrial transition, diversity, and conflicting beliefs and expectations are too often being reduced to questions of group definition, of group identity, and of group rights and entitlements. So individual experience, biographies, and rights tend to be underestimated together with their ambivalences. So we should be aware of that. And recognizing that, I quote the Ujupis Declaration of Human Rights. You know, perhaps Ujupis is a part of Vilnius, and it's in a way the Christiania of Vilnius, and there has been in the transition period, there have been artists and so-called alternative people who declare a new declaration of human rights. And there's one article in this declaration: there is a human right on not belonging to a collective and to a territory. However, the duty of every scholar, of course, is to investigate into the question why belonging to remains so central a point in modern society. When looking for an answer, I took inspiration from my Swedish colleague Cornelius Holthoff. He's an archaeologist and a specialist in cultural heritage studies. In one of his papers on cultural heritage management, he drives on behavioral economics and decision theory, referring to Daniel Kahneman's theory on loss aversion. What is loss aversion? This theory reads, according to this theory, people tend to prefer strongly avoiding losses to acquiring gains of the same kind. So other theories say it in other words, people have a preference of status quo over change. And Cornelius Wolthoff now puts a provocative question. Why do actual paradigms of cultural heritage conservation and cultural identity function in the same way? Why Western societies are so obsessed with the conservation of objects and the preservation of the status quo. How it comes that transition, transformation, change, and oblivion is declared as of minor value in comparison to the conservation and identity and memory. And why do people connect memory, first of all, to arrangements of objects and space and territory? Poltov, as an archaeologist, then suggests an interesting solution. It would be worth, he says, to discuss whether we could disentangle memory from objects, memory from material things. Do we necessarily need, in every case, to conserve objects in order to ensure communication on our past, on our common past, and in order to ensure social cohesion? Poltov continues then with Tim Ingold's novel's concepts of objects and human beings in constant transformation, and concludes that the meaning and the value of things transcends their given form at a specific point in time. For he takes an example, if you have a house, first, before the house comes into existence, you have a map of it, you are mapping it, you are planning it, there's a concept of the house, then it is built, then it is rebuilt, transformed, and perhaps destroyed, and afterwards the house may exist in memory. So this is one of these examples. So that means the value of things transcends their form. Even if material heritage perishes, memory does not have to perish together with it. So my suggestion would be to discuss on this ground, on this theoretical inspiration, to discuss such concepts of disentanglement for the minority issue as well. So the question is, must memory and social identity of minorities necessarily be connected to the material dimension of territory? Can we perhaps identify historical models of integration with disentangling moves, for example, the Austro-Marxist approaches to personal or cultural autonomy? And could that serve as a model for solving present problems? Can we develop processual and not static models of belonging to? If such models were developed in past societies, that's my typical question as a historian, why didn't they work in the past, or why did they first work and function and then perish? So this is my few rather, you know, tentative questions for our project. And let me close here with a few words, which I think it's really very actual with regard to our situation and Russian situation. Let me close with a few words from a German emigre song from the 1930s, from the time of fascism. Walter Mehring's Immigrantenchoral, the choir of emigrants. In a way, it's very actual with respect to our situation, and it is indeed on disentangling moves as well. It begins with these words: throw your heart over the border, forget what has been taken and stolen from you. Forget the Isar and the Spree and the northern shore, build a nest in the place where people look on you with a friendly gaze. And it adds, the emigre takes away all of his home and his little bit of fatherland from man to man, from place to place, on his soles and in his handkerchief. In German it's, die ganze Heimat und das bisschen Vaterland, die trägt der Immigrant von Mensch zu Mensch, von Ort zu Ort, an seinem Sohl und seinem Sacktuch mit sich fort. Thank you very much.
More suggestions to discuss. Unfortunately, we have a reservation at the restaurant, so we have to be a little bit... I would suggest to finish with your statement and then open up immediately for having a round of questions and then passing around and giving the possibility of cross-reflection at the podium. Willem, you were one of the opening statements, so... Do you have more to consider or to make us consider?
I will be short. And I can be short because I think we have had three wonderful contributions, three wonderful presentations. And I basically agree with many of the things that have been said. There are some overlapping things that I did prepare. And I do realize that I'm between you and the dinner, or the program, the dinner is very close, very close. I'm not sure we have any time left, to be honest, for a long Q&A. I will make some empirical observations and two more conceptual ones. The empirical observations have to do with the question that we have been discussing today. What exactly is diversity, and what is the diversity we are discussing? And I think one of the things we learned today, particularly in Marina's presentation, in fact, is to historicize diversity, right? So what is, in fact, because many people claim now, and I've been critical about that, in terms of super diversity, as if there's something totally new today, right? And so we are now more diverse than in the past. But of course, the question is, why should that be the case? Are we more diverse today? And we are just starting a huge research project in the Netherlands. We are looking into the question, who was considered to be native, Dutch native, in the past two centuries? And then there are many, many groups who have not been considered to be native to the Dutch nation, who are now part of the Dutch nation, who consider themselves as Dutch, but also who are considered by others to be Dutch, which is even more important, right? And in Dutch context, Roman Catholics were not considered to be Dutch, the people from the southern provinces were not considered to be Dutch, Frisians were not considered to be Dutch, the Roma were not considered to be Dutch, LGBTI people even didn't exist, right? At all. So national minorities, yes, ethnic minorities, but also a lot of intranational mobility was going on, and people were shocked in Rotterdam to live close to someone who was coming from Limburg. Right now, today we come slightly further away, but we don't know how people experience, in terms of alienation and strangeness, the very fact that people were coming from Limburg, because then in those days, that was at least as strange as people coming out from Morocco or Turkey, right? So I think we just lack an historical perspective. We don't know how people experience others. Or as far as we do know that people really were experiencing a lot of diversity, and if you want, even super diversity, 2 centuries ago as well, right? So it's very important to have a far better historical understanding when we talk about diversity. And of course it's hard to measure, because how can you measure how diverse societies were? Because in those days you didn't have survey, right? So we don't know how people experience itself. If you look into literature, for instance, or many other sources, we do know how people felt as strangers or and as nations were not nations, people didn't speak the same language and so on, right? So I think the historical question, is it more than before? It's hard to answer, but I'm for sure not sure that it is more diverse now. And if you discuss diversity, the second question obviously is what kind of diversity, right? Because particularly super diversity sounds so nice because you have all the diverse groups next to each other. But that's exactly what you showed in your presentation. That's rarely the case. It's about power differentials. It's about majorities and minorities, and majorities not giving space to minorities, or one of you framed it very nicely, majorities become minorities themselves and feel that discriminated against, right? So it's about the distance people feel to each other. It's about the predominant cleavages of our societies that are not necessarily the same. And it is, and that's what I want to emphasize mostly in this short presentation, it is about the majority these days being obsessed with questions of national identity. So yes, we should also pay attention to minorities, but I really, really want to have a plea for majority studies. We have to better understand the natives. The natives are acting strangely. They are voting for parties that they should never vote for, so we have to understand what the natives are doing, what those who consider themselves to be natives, what they are doing, right? Of course, always in relation to the minorities, but majority studies, that's what we are left with, mostly. And if you think about that, then what we do is, because we are so obsessed with national identities, we even think more and more that nations are different whenever we are comparing nations. But the question is, if you really want to understand majority-minority dynamics, we shouldn't overemphasize necessarily the national differences, because that's the obsession of the majorities. We should look into institutions. We should look into the army or hospitals or schools and make comparisons across countries because then you will see there are a lot of similarities across countries depending on the particular institution, instead of overemphasizing the anarcho-criticism methodological nationalism, right? So this is really the empirically to look far less on the national level and to go into the institutions. Last remarks regarding the conceptual renewal. I hate to be critical, but the thing is, and Olga already said that, that we have such an enormous overlap between categories of analysis and categories of practice, right? And it's particularly true in the field of integration and migration studies. I mean, there are people out there, scholars and politicians, who speak the language of multicultural models, or Republican model, right? The French scholars and the French politicians. Total overlap of those categories, and that's one of the most worrying things. Because I can show you the Dutch have never had a multicultural model, the politicians will say, well, we have a multicultural model, and that failed, an integration failed because of multiculturalism, and therefore we now need monoculturalism. It's all nonsensical. We never had a multicultural policies, never a model. Disintegration failed? Question mark. But nobody takes that seriously because scientists and politicians speak sort of in the same language. That's of course not just you're proposing, right? You're proposing a language and concepts that are specific for our analysis, right? So category of analysis that is not overlapping with the language of politicians or those who participate in public debate. And we are far from that, particularly in this field that is so politicized, and we have many of our colleagues who participate in the public debate using exactly the same terms as the politicians. And that's the worst, because then we are feeding into this idea that models exist. Models are for scientists. Models are indeed reductionists. We sometimes need a certain form of reduction to think about causality, to think about how things are related. But models now are used by politicians to say, oh, we have models, as if politicians ever work with models. I mean, that's not the way politics works. I'm not going into detail there. So therefore, I really think we need other categories, categories that do not overlap. My final remarks. Yes, home and belonging. We really should ask the question why secularization resonates so much. It's not only the thing politicians are speaking about, but it resonates a lot with the voters, as we see, right? And that is because they also speak the language, as I tried to explain earlier today, this language of feeling at home. And they think that they are helpful because that sounds nice, that everyone should feel at home. But if we really take the study of feeling at home seriously, then we discover on the one hand that it is a very structural emotion, and it is not an emotion that should be politicized. But if you look into the components of what it is to belong and to feel at home, then we do realize that it's of course about familiarity, right? You should be familiar with that. But the other defining elements are very close to being secure. It's about feeling safe, it's about feeling secure, right? So the more we are emphasizing people should belong and they belong to a certain territory, the more we are feeding into the agenda of security, right? So it's not coincidence that some parties are speaking both the language of security and the language of belonging. And that, final words, shows the importance of the study of the majority, right? Because this is all about the majority. It's the way the majority produces itself as a claim to the soil, as a claim to the ground, as the most native or more native than the minorities. And we have to better understand that.
Thank you very much.